A peace process, but no peace. Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Northern Ireland's troubles aren't entirely in the past, and now there's concern that Brexit might disturb what peace there is.
We're in a peace process, but we're not at peace. Brexit to us is much more than tariffs. It's much more than exchange rates. It's more about who we are, where we live, and how we want to get on with our neighbours and friends.
Plus, the acting head of ICE doesn't like the way Oakland's mayor protects undocumented immigrants.
What she did is no better than a gang lookout yelling police when a police cruiser comes in the neighborhood, except she did it to the entire community.
And singer Claudia Fontaine always set the mood.
Rehearsal doesn't start until Claudia actually arrives and brings the vibe.
Ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. A lot of Russia news to digest this week. New sanctions stemming from Russian meddling in the U.S. election. Russian diplomats expelled from the U.K. over a nerve agent attack there. And coming up this weekend, a presidential vote in Russia with the man at the center of it all, Vladimir Putin, up for re-election. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. And Charles, I understand his chances of winning are pretty good.
They are pretty good, Carol. In fact, Putin will win. No one doubts that. But, you know, what's interesting here is just, you know, how much drama and intrigue there is around a race whose outcome fundamentally has none. In Putin's case, you know, the real concern here is not winning so much as it is turnout. It's the way Putin wins, how it looks. And key to that is getting enough people out to vote on Sunday to make this victory feel like a mandate to him after 18 years in power. It's tough to generate excitement when you've been around for that long. And, you know, on that point, I'd like to introduce you, if I could, to someone. This is Slava Nesterov. He's a 29-year-old artist from the Ural Mountains originally, but now lives in Moscow.
И этот календарь называется «Путин на каждый день до 2120 года».
Slava made some news here because of a calendar he published. It's a calendar that's all about Vladimir Putin.
A Putin calendar?
Yeah, well, it's not exactly a real calendar. There are no months, there are no days. They're just images of Putin and a list of all these fictitious accomplishments over the years. So, you know, you have President Putin doing something great in 2018, then in 2024, then in 2047, then 2078, all the way into the next century.
I think I get it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's this idea that Putin is forever here in Russian politics. And now Nesterov, the artist, he says this is all kind of tongue-in-cheek, it's a joke, but it does have a serious point.
Но скажу на самом деле сразу, что...
And his point is this, you know, he does respect Vladimir Putin. He gives him a lot of credit for what he's done over the years. But he says that, you know, 18 years in power is just too long. He wants to see some change at the top. And I think you can feel this enthusiasm gap more and more these days in Russia. I mean, just anecdotally, I've spoken with people who say, you know, they agree with Putin's foreign policy, for example, but think he does a poor job on the domestic front with the economy. Or you hear people say, you know, they don't really care for Putin, but what's the point anyway? There's no one else to choose from.
Well, there are other people to choose from. There's other candidates.
Well, there are. I mean, first we should say that the main challenger, Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, and arguably the biggest threat to Putin, has been barred from the race on a legal technicality. Navalny is actually calling for a boycott of the election and instead for close monitoring of the vote, you know, essentially to deny Putin's win the sense of legitimacy that he craves. But because of these calls to boycott, his supporters have been harassed constantly by Russian security services. Many, in fact, have been jailed in advance of the vote to keep them away from voting precincts on Sunday. But, you know, to get to your point, yes, there are other candidates in the race. Just to give you a sense, just a bit of a taste of what Russians see when they consider the alternatives to Putin, here's a bit of tape from a recent presidential debate.
Whoa, what's going on there?
Well, it's a circus. That's what's going on. You know, something actually nearly everybody on that stage admits openly. But, you know, more importantly, what you're witnessing is simulated competition. These candidates, the Kremlin knows, even the candidates know that they pose no threat. So many agree that they're not even trying to win. And fundamentally, they're in the race, or they've been allowed into the race, in the case of some of the critics of Putin, just to generate public interest in the election, to get people out to the polls and make this feel like a real vote.
Does Putin participate in these debates?
No, he never has. In all these 18 years in power, his campaign, or his campaign style, as much as you can call it that, is largely based on this idea that he's too busy being the national leader. He's too busy being president or acting presidential to stoop to actually running for the job. That says he uses other means to make his case to the public.
Настоящим технологическим прорывом является создание перспективного ракетного комплекса стратегического назначения.
So, for example, earlier this month, he gave a speech where he unveiled a series of new supposedly invincible superweapons aimed at the U.S. In a video display, one missile even appears to blow up the state of Florida. But, you know, Putin argues these weapons are in response to missile defense systems that the U.S. has put in place in Eastern Europe and Asia. But the point really is this, you know, he's presenting himself as the national leader. He's thinking of Russia's national interests and, of course, defending Russia against what he presents as a really hostile world. While the rest of these other candidates, you know, they just squabble amongst themselves.
Well, that may be so, but we hear so much about Navalny and how he connects with younger Russians, especially on the corruption issue. Is that reflected in the race at all?
Well, in a way, yes. One of the things that was so surprising about Navalny's failed attempt to get into the election was just how successfully he built a national movement. And he did this with just the internet and, you know, no access to state television except for negative attention to him. And he's managed repeatedly to bring thousands of Russians in cities across the country out onto the streets to protest corruption in the Kremlin over the past year. Keep in mind, this is not just so much the numbers of people out on the streets as it is the demographic. Navalny started connecting with younger Russians, many of them who've only known Putin as their president. And they find Navalny, with his anti-corruption message, you know, an interesting figure, not to mention nearly 25 years younger than Vladimir Putin. And you can see that the Kremlin was really spooked by this episode. It caught them off guard, and we see, you know, Putin adjusting his politics to compensate to a certain degree. Suddenly, Putin seems to spend a lot of time around younger Russians. He suddenly talks about, you know, digital technologies and cryptocurrencies, and he's always trying to show that he can connect. And, you know, also helping him are Russian pop stars and, you know, members of Russian sort of pop elite, which have been working overtime to promote Putin as this kind of cool, vital guy. For example, Carol, I can point to a Russian girl band. This is a band called Fabrika, or Factory. You know, they released a video where the three members of the group have competing sexual fantasies about Putin, or Vova, a nickname for Vladimir, as they call him in the song.
Oh, please. Must we?
We must. So the point is, there is a heavy-handed attempt to make this, okay, more or less healthy, but still 65-year-old Vladimir Putin, as he sets out on another six-year term, seem like a symbol of the future, you know, someone who can lead Russia forward. And I have to say, there are some Russians, younger Russians, who agree.
Мне повезло. Нет, я занималась и раньше организацией мероприятий в Молодой гвардии именно в Саратове.
So this is Ekaterina. She didn't give me her last name, but she is a 23-year-old member of Молодая гвардия, or Young Guard. This is a pro-Kremlin youth group. And she's also a member of this Putin's team. This is a group of Putin supporters in these elections who've been organizing online.
But don't these Kremlin efforts seem totally fake to most Russians?
You know, they do to a lot of people. I think that's quite clear. On the other hand, you see this kind of get out the vote movement here. So there have been incentives put in place by, you know, people getting prizes, for example, by going out to vote or getting free medical exams or other things that might just interest people and get them out to the polls. So again, the focus here is really on just getting the vote out. It doesn't even matter if you vote for or against Vladimir Putin. They know that he'll win anyway.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you.
We're going to spend the next few minutes on that nerve agent attack in the UK. The British government is blaming Russia for the poisoning of a former Russian double agent and his daughter, Sergei and Yulia Skripal. The chemical weapon used in the attack is called Novichok. It was developed by scientists in the former Soviet Union starting in the 1970s, but its existence wasn't known to the world until the 1990s. That's when the Chemical Weapons Convention was signed.
A number of Russian scientists surfaced at that point to say, raise questions of, we've got this international treaty now to ban chemical weapons. Why are we still doing work on this particular group of compounds which are not being declared under this new international system?
Richard Guthrie is an independent chemical weapons expert. He spoke with us from London. I asked him what effects Novichok agents have on the human body.
all of the nerve agents interfere with the signals that pass through the nervous system so that your muscles don't work properly, your lungs don't work properly, your heart doesn't beat properly. And of course, with those things going wrong, it creates tremendous health effects in the body.
Do we know yet how Sergei Skripal and his daughter came into contact with Novichok?
There's been no official confirmation of the method by which this got into the bodies of the people who've unfortunately been exposed to it. But really, there's only a few ways of doing it. You either breathe it in, you eat it, or you get it on the skin.
Now, both Sergei Skripal and his daughter are still in critical condition. What are the medical challenges in helping them recover?
Well, there are a number of medical challenges. The first basic one is because the Novichok family is so large and it's not been identified which of the Novichoks was specifically used, there may be a lot of unknowns for the medical staff. But this is one of the things that I think has horrified people about the Russian response. They did, because they were thinking of using them as chemical weapons, they will have looked at potential treatments for their own staff being contaminated. And it would appear the Russians have not been forthcoming with any suggestions of if there was any other medical information that would be useful. And that, to me, speaks volumes.
Of course, the Russians are denying any involvement in this. Based on what you know about chemical weapons and Novichok specifically, do you suspect that what was used in the attack in the UK came from a stockpile, or that it's still in development, given how nerve agents age?
Most of these compounds do not store for a long period. The other thing is the way the law is structured in terms of international law. You're not supposed to store these things, and you're not supposed to have them for use as a weapon, but if you have them for peaceful purposes, that's perfectly all right. If I was the Russians, I'm not sure I would want to stock these materials, especially if you've worked out how you can produce them at short notice. And that, I think, is going to be an important challenge. There may be no smoking gun in terms of a stockpile sitting in a room, just a large amount of ingredients that could actually be used for other purposes. That's the difficulty.
Have we seen Novichok being used anywhere else?
This is the first time that I'm aware of that a laboratory has been able to specifically identify one of the Novichok class of compounds as having been used against a human being.
Why would the Russian government, if it indeed was the Russian government, use this weapon in this attack if the history of Novichok is one that leads right back to Russia and before that the Soviet Union?
You could ask the same question, why did the Russians carry out the assassination of Litvinenko 12 years ago? He was a Russian dissident living in London who was poisoned with radioactive material. Everybody who was examining the case in any detail came to the conclusion it was the Russian authorities carried it out. Again, it wasn't the sort of level of proof that could be easily used in a criminal court. And so this is very similar. This is a statement of power. This is a statement of, look, this is what we can do.
Well, by extension, it must also mean that the Russian government thinks it can get away with it.
I think that's the thoughts that were probably going in the minds of the people who planned it, but I think the repercussions perhaps weren't thought through. I think there are a lot of governments who are looking at this and going, we are concerned that there could be people who will use this on our streets, and so, you know, we don't want this to happen again.
Richard Guthrie is an independent chemical weapons expert. He was previously with the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you.
Brexit's effect on Ireland. That's up next on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. I'm from northern New York, so the international border I'm most familiar with is the one with Canada. Back in the day, we could drive right across the border, no passport required, just a driver's license, and no hassles. Things are different now. You definitely need a passport, you're questioned a lot more, and the lines can be long. Our next story is about a very different border, the one between Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the European Union and will remain so after Brexit. The UK decision to leave the EU has raised big questions about that border. The World's Matthew Bell went for a visit.
Here's the thing about the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Nowadays, there isn't one. But here on the Buncrana Road, just outside of the northern city of Londonderry, there's a reminder of the bad old days when this border was a flashpoint. It's a little memorial with the names of the victims of an IRA attack who died right here.
We all panicked. and for shock. And the children were all crying and screaming. Oh, it was terrible.
This is a BBC report from October 1990.
In Derry, five soldiers died at the permanent vehicle checkpoint on a road leading to the Irish Republic on the outskirts of the city. Four masked men took a man from his home in Derry while his family were held hostage. It's understood he was forced to drive the bomb right into the checkpoint and that it went off before he could give a warning.
Actually, if you look across, if you see that huge ash tree, you can see it was damaged in the bomb, right? And this was the site of the British Army, big British Army barracks here.
Eamon O'Keara teaches Irish language and history at Ulster University. He shows me around the spot where that bombing took place here on the border. It's where County Donegal in the south ends and County Londonderry in the north begins.
Like, I remember when there was a hard border here, when you had big barracks here.
Did you ever drive across with your family?
Oh, many's a time. You know, I was born in 1968, the year the trouble started. So I remember hard borders. I remember being stopped.
And if you pulled up here in a civilian car with a family, then you'd be pulled over and questioned.
They would stop you. They would ask you your name, where you were from. They'd put mirrors under the car. They'd maybe search the car. They could arrest you.
Mirrors looking for an explosive.
Yeah, explosives or weapons. They could arrest you. They didn't have to tell you why they were arresting you. They could hold you for 7 days without charging you.
As we talk, traffic flows freely back and forth across a border that, practically speaking, was erased in 1998.
Ultimately, what you see here is the political and economic dividend and cultural dividend of the Good Friday Agreement. These cars are passing unimpeded, right?
Not even hitting their brakes.
Not even hitting their brakes. And the only way you know that you're in Northern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland is the signage. You know, Irish language signs, they're bilingual in the Republic of Ireland. But if every one of these cars had to stop for 2 minutes, it would be a catastrophe.
And it's a catastrophe that pretty much everyone around here would like to avoid. Take Christine and Mark Doherty, for instance. They work in Derry. Their kids go to school in the city. They shop in Derry. But the Dohertys live in the countryside, about 20 minutes away, across the border in Donegal.
Christine grew up in Derry, too.
Christine would grew up in Londonderry, as she'll probably tell you. And no, we're an odd family, I think.
Yeah.
A beginning of a new generation, let's call it that.
A new generation because Mark is Catholic. Catholics in the north call the city Derry. Christine grew up Protestant. Protestants call it Londonderry. Back during the Troubles, a mixed marriage like theirs in Derry, Londonderry would have been close to unthinkable.
That's another reason why we kind of moved out to Donegal as well, out of the city, to get away from street politics, you know, that type of thing. You want your children to grow up without knowing all of the turmoil that we knew.
If we were to choose somewhere to stay in Derry or to live in Derry, you would need to choose, and making that choice, you would be living in a very Catholic area or a very Protestant area and having to explain one or the other.
But the city has changed a lot in the last 20 years, and one of the biggest symbols of that is the Peace Bridge. It connects the Catholic and Protestant sides of the city across the Foyle River. It was paid for by the European Union, which Mark points out is kind of ironic now.
With Brexit, there's going to be a border with Europe, you know, so that it wouldn't have been built 10 years from now. You know, that probably wouldn't have happened.
For the Dohertys, who drive back and forth across the border multiple times a day, the idea of an actual border crossing, like the one between the U.S. and Canada, raises lots of questions.
Are we going to be stopped every single time that we're going to cross the border? It was militarized before, so it was slightly different, but are they going to have customs officers there? Are you going to have your driving license checked? Are you going to have the car checked? Are you going to be questioned every single time you go across? Is it going to cause delays? Because the amount of traffic that goes across that border on a daily basis, just in our small section of it.
Yeah. It's hard enough to get to work with three kids as it is in the morning. But if you're going to be held up at a checkpoint, you could be much later.
That's going to make it difficult for us.
When I talk to people on the street in the city centre of Derry, I hear a pretty strong consensus that Brexit could be very bad for the Irish on both sides of the border. There's already a political stalemate in Northern Ireland, with the two main parties unable to form a government. People here are worried that the politics of Brexit are just making things worse. Sinead McLaughlin is the head of the Londonderry Chamber of Commerce.
I've been walking up and down the main street here, talking to people, asking about what's on their minds about Brexit, and I got sort of a range of views. Some people think it's dumb, and some people think it's really dumb. Are you surprised?
No, I'm not. It just shows you that, you know, a society such as ours, that we're in a peace process, but we're not at peace. We have an open border, and it's not just an open border for the economy, but it's about that social cohesion. It's about people being open to one another, and it's about growing and developing that shared space that we share. Brexit to us is much more than tariffs. It's much more than exchange rates. It's more about who we are, where we live, and how we want to get on with our neighbours and friends.
Some of David Bell's neighbours and friends voted yes to Brexit. Bell is from the Protestant side of Londonderry. He's a lay minister at the big Protestant cathedral here, St. Columb's. But Bell says he voted no for a few reasons.
The economic uncertainty, the lack of a plan, and the effect it would have on the constitutional status of Northern Ireland.
What do you mean by that?
That it is an integral part of the United Kingdom and wishes to remain so, unless the population here decides otherwise.
Suddenly, after the Brexit vote, Bell says there's renewed talk about a united Ireland, which he and other Protestants are not happy about at all. And in the meantime, he says the political fight over what happens with the border is threatening to unravel the peace process.
So when you think about Brexit, you worry about, it sounds like, the troubles coming back?
Yes, yes, that is a real possibility, that the IRA, because they never said that they said that, you know, they've put aside their arms, so have the loyalist paramilitaries. What happens if this whole thing implodes? And it could happen. Let's not kid ourselves.
For The World, Matthew Bell, along the border in Northern Ireland.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. Journalist Dan Carino's family immigrated from the Philippines, but not together. His father was the first to leave Manila for a job in New Jersey.
That was the first time that I realized that we might not be together.
It was almost a decade before the family was reunited. Their story, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Recently, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, arrested 232 people in Northern California over 4 days. But ICE says the number of arrests should have been higher, like 800 higher. The agency's acting head, Thomas Homan, blamed Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf for that. Homan blasted Schaaf for issuing a warning to residents ahead of the ICE operation.
What she did is no better than a gang lookout yelling police when a police cruiser comes in the neighborhood, except she did it to the entire community.
California is a so-called sanctuary state. That means authorities there choose not to cooperate with the federal government to enforce immigration laws. ICE is also facing criticism from within its ranks. An ICE spokesman in California, James Schwab, recently quit over what he said were misleading remarks by top ICE officials. And the situation has highlighted how ICE is changing under the Trump administration. The World's Marnette Fedaris is here to explain. Marnette, what were the misleading remarks that James Schwab says led him to quit?
So James Schwab is the former ICE spokesperson who is disputing this 800 figure. It's not just Acting Director Thomas Homan that's mentioned this figure. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in a speech here in California, said that ICE failed to make arrests that could have been made if it wasn't for the Oakland mayor. But James Schwab basically argues that while the agency had about 1,000 people on its target list, there was no way that they could have gotten to all those people. During these types of special operations, only a portion of the target list are actually arrested. So he felt that to say the mayor's warning let 800 people get away is just not true. There's just no way to know that. But the agency still says that the mayor's warning did make an impact and that ICE agents actually arrested a lower percentage of people in comparison to other operations that they conduct.
We know that ICE has been making more arrests under the Trump administration. Is that because ICE tactics have changed?
Yes. So there's been about 30% more arrests this fiscal year, 2017, compared to the previous year. And that's without the agency increasing the number of agents that it has on the field. So those who study these numbers believe that the agency has been able to do this by increasing the number of arrests made for people who don't have criminal histories except for their immigration violations. I actually talked to Doris Meissner, who is with the Migration Policy Institute and is a former commissioner for the agency that's the precursor to ICE and Border Patrol, and she describes the agent's tactics.
If, for instance, they find somebody who does have a criminal background but who didn't comply with a former order of deportation, they are now typically asking other people who might live in that same building or who might be working at a similar place to tell them about their immigration status. That would not have been happening a year or two ago.
Marnette, ICE officials characterize the group who were not arrested in this latest operation as a security risk. But it's a little more complicated than that.
A lot of the folks that are on these target lists are people that have been convicted with crimes. But a lot of the times, ICE will also arrest people whose only violations is really their immigration violation and not so much being convicted of felonies and that sort of thing. Under the Trump administration, it seems that anyone who is considered removable, whether or not you have a criminal background, is subject to be arrested. I think it's safe to say that it's pretty concerning for immigrant advocates. The kind of rhetoric that's coming from high-ranking officials, including acting director of ICE, seem to be really focused on talking about immigrants as public safety threats.
Now, the head of ICE and Attorney General Jeff Sessions have been attacking Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf since the recent ICE operations there. How do you think that's going to play out? I mean, what does it mean for ICE in California?
It seems likely that these kinds of operations will keep going. So part of what ICE has always argued is that these sanctuary policies force them to go out into the neighborhoods or to go to workplaces because they can't do their work in county jails or prisons, which is what sanctuary policies actually try to minimize. Of course, on the other side of that argument is that local law enforcement and jurisdictions say that they can't do their jobs if residents feel like they're working with immigration agents. So both sides seem to be pretty set on these positions. And I think that people are worried and are basically bracing themselves for more of these types of special operations.
That was Marnette Fedaris with our Global Nation Desk. Leaving one's country to build a new life here in the U.S. can be a really difficult step to take. Even when it involves legally issued visas, the process can mean a long and painful separation from loved ones. That was the case for Dan Carino. Dan's an illustrator and political cartoonist based in California. He recently did some work for us online as part of our Walls We Don't See immigration series. Dan was born in the Philippines, so we asked him to share and illustrate his own family's story of coming to America. That's when Dan realized he didn't really know much about it.
As a matter of fact, you know, even as a family, we haven't even really discussed fully, you know, the experiences that we went through when we moved here to the U.S. So it was something that I really had to go back and revisit, and it was definitely revealing.
Dan's father came to the U.S. from the Philippines to work as a nurse in 1982. He left behind a wife and three boys, including Dan. His father was granted a work permit, but not U.S. residency, so his family couldn't join him. Dan was just 4 years old at the time. He was eight when his mother also found work in the U.S. He was 13 when he saw them again. So to a large extent, he and his two younger brothers grew up without their parents.
I was living with an uncle and two aunts at the time during the school year in this apartment in Quezon City. And during the summer, we'd get sent over to my grandma's in the province of Isabela. So our life was really kind of divided up into, you know, a life in the city during the school year and a life in the province.
How often were you in touch with your parents?
Not a lot, just because at the time, you know, there was no Skype, there was no WhatsApp, and we didn't have a phone in our apartment. So we actually had to go to the main office of the Philippine long distance company, stand in line with a lot of folks trying to reach their loved ones in other parts of the world. And we would call collect, and the cost of a collect callback then was a lot. My mom told me that, you know, half of her paycheck went to the cost of talking to us on the phone. So it was, we would try to do it maybe like once a month, every other month, and that was it.
What year are you finally able to go to the U.S. with your brothers to join your parents?
That was in 1991, September of 1991.
So that was almost 10 years.
Right.
And do you remember your first impressions? I think you arrived in San Francisco.
We arrived in San Francisco, and then we flew back down to L.A. to go home to Riverside at the time. And by the time that we got to Los Angeles, it was nighttime. I remember just driving on the 91 freeway or the 60 freeway and feeling like it was a big world just because of the space and how it seemed like everything was working efficiently. Cars were all going the same way and it was all structured. And yeah, and I remember playing basketball the very first night we arrived. And I played basketball with my brothers the whole night, because we had our own hoop in the backyard that my dad had built. And in the Philippines, there were no basketball courts, even though we loved the sport so much. And you would just find, you know, makeshift hoops in every corner. And it was amazing to come home to, hey, you have your own basketball hoops now. You can shoot it.
How old were you when you arrived in 1991?
I was already 13. So, you know, I sort of had an idea of who I wanted to be in the world, or at least I thought so. I honestly didn't want to come to the U.S. at the time. I thought my friends and, you know, my future was in the Philippines.
Your father was able to get permanent residency in part because his employer in California helped sponsor his green card. And so, you know, you arrive and your parents had another child while they were in the U.S., so you had another brother.
Right. Yeah. Mark, who's the youngest brother, was born in California. And the first time we met him was in 1991 when my parents came back to pick us up. And we've only seen him in pictures up to that point.
Your father and mother have explained the cost of their absence by saying to you, it was the cost of securing a future for our family. Did that mean much to you at the time they said it to you? And does it mean something different today?
Of course, of course. At the time, I didn't really fully understand what they were sort of doing and what they were sacrificing. And I didn't understand why we had to be separated at the time. And also what they were chasing. The American dream was unfamiliar to me at the time as a kid. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what America stood for and the opportunities that it presents for a different life. But today, especially when I look at other stories, I do realize that, yes, you know, these are decisions and opportunities that folks are willing to take at this point. And the sacrifice sometimes are great, and that affects families.
You don't have to answer this, but I was curious, when you were reunited in the United States in 1991, did it take a while to have your parents feel like parents to you, based on the fact that you were raised for so many years not by them?
Yes. And during that time, I did, you know, sort of understand like the nuclear family and who they were. But I think my challenge at the time was to sort of demonstrate to my brothers as well that these are your parents, because they're the ones that really did not understand who my mom and dad were at the time. And they fully didn't understand why they were here in the U.S. As a matter of fact, my brother Chris, after a few weeks or I think a couple of months here in the U.S., began asking when are we going to go back to the Philippines, because he's seen America. So that didn't really sink in with them.
Because they were younger.
Exactly, like the permanence. They thought they were here for a trip, you know, to go see Disneyland, SeaWorld, and all this stuff, and they were going to go back to the Philippines. And also my parents, I know that they struggled to sort of raise four boys that were not, or at least three of us, that were not used to having parents around. So we weren't the easiest kids to kind of, you know, raise at that point.
What was it like for you emotionally going back over this time in your life?
It was definitely tough. It brought back a lot of heartbreak, but it also answered a lot of the resentment that I felt at the time, or even sort of kind of like growing up with questions that were left unanswered So this process really sort of kind of outlined to me what my parents were trying to do, and that they really had our best interest in mind, regardless of what I thought at the time was them just being, you know, just leaving their kids. So it was a lot of emotions going back. I definitely cried a couple of times in the process, and so did my mom when I interviewed her. Because, you know, you do remember the times, you do remember the separation, and a lot of that is still very much, you know, inside of me. And these are the experiences that I've carried since I got to the U.S.
Dan Carino is a graphic journalist and political cartoonist. He's drawn and written about his own experience emigrating to the United States from the Philippines for our ongoing series, Walls We Don't See. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Carol.
You really have to see Dan's beautifully illustrated story about his family's journey to America. It's at PRI.org. A quick update now on a couple of stories about United Airlines and the way it handles pets. United has a lot of explaining to do on this. First, there was the death of a puppy on a flight from Houston to New York. The dog's owners say a flight attendant insisted they place their pet carrier in the overhead bin for the duration of the flight. The airline later apologized and said the flight attendant didn't realize there was a dog inside the carrier. United also promised to implement a new policy to prevent such incidents in the future. Prosecutors in Texas and New York are looking into filing animal cruelty charges in the case. Then there's the story of Ergo, the 10-year-old German shepherd. His family put him on a United flight in Portland, Oregon, headed for Kansas City with a connection in Denver. But as Ergo's owner, Cara Swindle, told CNN, she got a big surprise when she went to pick him up in Kansas City.
So they brought me back into their warehouse where they hold the kennels, and I saw his kennel, I called his name, and up popped this Great Dane instead. And it's just instant tears. I didn't even know what to think. Just so worried about where my dog was instead.
Turns out, Ergo was sent to Japan instead. United says it accidentally switched the German Shepherd with the Great Dane in Denver. More apologies from United, and a couple of long-haul flights later, the Great Dane was back in Japan, and Ergo was reunited with his family here in the U.S. But first, as Swindle told ABC's Good Morning America, there was one more surprise.
He was supposed to come back just in a cabin on the regular flight, but for some reason, United wouldn't let him fly in the cabin. So they decided doing their corporate jet would be the best bet and got him there a whole lot faster as well.
Despite the corporate jet treatment, Kara Swindle says she's considering taking legal action against United. She says she wants to make sure what happened to Ergo doesn't happen again. Claudia Fontaine passed away this week at the age of 57. You may not recognize her name, but I guarantee you've heard her voice before, like on this Elvis Costello classic. And on other big hits from the 1980s, by Soul to Soul, The Specials, Annie Lennox, Howard Jones, Pink Floyd, and many, many others. Claudia Fontaine sang backup for all of them, including Levi Roots. Levi Roots is a reggae singer as well as a celebrated chef and businessman, and he's with us from London. Levi, first, I'm so sorry for your loss. How did you know Claudia Fontaine?
You know, Claudia and I grew up in Brixton, South London, and I think we kind of discovered, you know, Rastafari together, as most young kids in the South London at the time, you know, were struggling trying to find some identity. And our only sort of reasons to get some kind of cultural education was through reggae music. And so I met her when we were both searching for some sort of cultural existence. And then the music just sort of came in a bit later on.
She played backup for you and many, many others. Michael Hann, who writes about music for The Guardian, wrote that Aphrodisiac, the trio she was part of, they were the backing singers of choice for much of the 1980s. Talk about her musical impact.
Yeah, well, she had a massive impact. You know, she was always go-to person when someone's searching to put a band together and wanted somebody to have great, you know, vocal skills. It was always Claudia. But she really came alive when she got international. I think we felt very proud for her when Soul to Soul came on the scene in the 80s. And we knew that this sound was now taking over the whole world. But it was a British concept. And it was very proud for South London people to see Claudia was instrumental in the whole Soul to Soul sound.
You mentioned Soul to Soul, and we're going to hear a little bit of Back to Life. It was a really prominent song in the 80s, and Claudia was a huge part of that.
Back to life.
back to reality, back to life, back to reality.
You can really hear her voice here. It's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think visually as well, she played a massive part in the whole visual and fashion of what was happening in the 80s with Soul to Soul as well, because it was the time of the funky dread. And because Claudia, you know, she was a Rastafari woman, and she had the dreadlocks, and she really stood for what the image was at the time. And I think it took on around the world.
Now, there are other songs where you can really hear her range, like in Pink Floyd's Great Gig in the Sky. Let's listen to just a bit of her solo. You knew Claudia for a long time. Did she ever express interest in being kind of the front person, or did she like her role as backup singer?
I think she's had a bit of both of that, because I think within her solo career, because one of her most famous songs, I mean, here amongst her own sort of grassroots people here in London, is a song called Natural Eye, which was one of her very first songs. And I think that song has become an iconic song within her genre, which is where she was, of Lover's Rock. Lover's Rock was a British version of what reggae was. And Claudia's track, Natural Eye, was instrumental in when Lover's Rock was being created. And so she's pretty much got her own history amongst as a lead vocalist herself.
Reaction when you heard of her death at just 57?
Oh, I was in my restaurant, and I absolutely had to sit down for a while, because I just spoke to her the week before, because we had some new shows coming up, and she was so happy that, you know, we were going back on the road. You know, that was her life. She's a bit like was our cheerleader within the band. There's 13 of us in the band. And she's a bit like the mother hen, you know, and that's just sort of gets everyone together when she's not in rehearsal. Rehearsal doesn't start until Claudia actually arrives and brings the vibe. She was everything. I absolutely missed her. And to hear the news, it's just unbelievable to hear it.
And do you have any observations about her singing style?
Yes, well, she was always known for her range. I think this is why people always searched her out. Because of the range and how she has a fantastic vocal control, and because she practices. And I've seen her mentor other young singers. This is the other thing she started to do recently before she passed away. She was going around to schools and other young artists and trying to pass on the heart of vocaling to them. Yeah, so I think there are some lucky people out there who've had Claudia Fontaine to show them one and two of her skills.
Yeah. Is it especially sad that Claudia Fontaine died with so few people knowing her name?
Yes, I think there's an essence of that. But I do think that when we check the music now and see what she's done, it's never going to be too late in music for people to start knowing your achievements, especially if you've been inspirational. I don't think that it matters that she didn't really have, you know, worldwide fame as Claudia Fontaine individually. But I think collectively, when you look at what she's done, I think people will now will stand up and say, wow, this woman, you know, she is one of the real unsung heroes. And now we should start singing her name. You know, she shouldn't be unsung. We should actually start singing her.
Levi Roots is a reggae singer who recently toured with Claudia Fontaine. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Claudia Fontaine died this week at the age of 57. We'll leave you with another of the great songs she sang on. Free Nelson Mandela by The Specials.
Free, 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 free.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Public Radio International.